Today's special program is dedicated to our partner and dear friend, Gary Lilly. Gary was killed by a drunk driver on August 4th, 2011. Our program today includes two of Gary's favorite interviews. The first is from 2007 as Gary interviews dog handlers Barb Kanarski and Vance McCrum. The second is with Gary's good friend and veteran troubadour, Michael J. Martin, from 2004. This is for Gary and all of us who miss him.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program,
Gary Lilly.
Good morning, America, and to all of our military personnel serving our country around the world, whether on ship, in the air, or on land. Welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Gary Lilly, CB, July 66, and I'm your host. Good morning also to all of the veterans who have served our nation. There are countries around the world that enjoy freedom today, thanks to you. And a special good morning to all of the dog handlers and former dog handlers listening in today, with a special greeting and welcome home to our friends listening in from down under, the men of the Vietnam Veterans Dog Handlers Association of Australia and New Zealand. Today, Veterans Radio is going to the dogs. We're going to hear the story of two of our best friends who served our country in war. They're not with us today, but will be well represented by their handlers, Vance McCrum and Bob Kanarski. As I mentioned, today's show is going to the dogs. We're going to hear about the war dogs. Fearless, loyal, honest. They say that there would have been 10,000 more names on the wall had it not been for the dogs. Sitting here in the booth is Vance McCrum, who's going to be representing Dutch. Good morning, Vance.
Good morning, Gary.
And down in West Virginia, joining us is Bob Kanarski, representing Opal. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Bob, we're going to start off with you. Tell us about Opal.
Opal was a black lab female. She was 7 years old when I got her. She had served some other handlers before me. And I always tell people that I didn't handle her. She handled me.
She knew her job pretty well then.
Yeah, she's the one that kept me out of trouble.
What kind of a dog was, what was Opal's job? What class?
She was a tracker.
That meant what, Bob?
Our job was, when contact was broken, we were inserted to track and reestablish contact with the enemy. And we were unique in the fact that most dogs were just a dog and a handler, whereas we were a five-man team with the dog, the handler, visual trackers that, you know, could go out like the old Indians and track you through the fields and stuff, our cover men, and a team leader. So we were unique, where we weren't just a dog and handler. We were a team.
So your job was to go out looking for the bad guys, to actively seek and find the enemy.
Right. We actively sought out the enemy.
And it was immediately after a firefight or a battle?
Yes. Generally, right after a firefight, or they would have suspect activity in an area, and we would go in and look for signs. Excuse me, look for signs of the enemy.
Would you go out to the spot then where assuming there was an ambush that was sprung or a battle took place, you'd go over to their location where they had been. Is that correct?
Right. We were inserted at the last point of contact, and we would establish the track, follow up on the track.
How would Opal know who to look for, who was bad and who was good?
They really don't know who's bad or who is good. The idea is that we would give her a track to follow, and then she would follow. You know, a dog will follow any track you put them on. You know, be it good or bad, this is what we want you to follow, go follow it.
And what would happen when you'd, assuming you would catch up with the enemy at times?
Yes, we did.
What would Opal do?
They would alert to the location of the enemy. Opal would take, the closer we got, her chest would drop to the ground and she would pull and dig and pull towards the enemy. You know, each dog had their own alert, and that was her alert. And after a while, I got to tell, by her actions, I could pinpoint the enemy to within 15 yards.
Really? Now, who's that in the background?
So that's, you know, they were very good at that.
Who is that?
That is Roger and Jude, my two, I have a yellow and a black lab.
Okay, and so they're agreeing with everything you say, right?
Yeah, well, there's somebody pulling up in the driveway.
All right, so it comes natural to those guys. So when you could locate them within 15 yards, that's a, you must have been in the jungles?
I was up in the Ikor area, which was predominantly small mountains and triple canopy jungle.
Really? Okay, that's where I was, Ikor. Now, so there was the dog out front and you a leash length behind, and how many people behind you?
Well, there would be the rest of my team and the unit that called us in.
Okay.
Which would be from squad to company size.
So you would be back at a main base. Somewhere out there, a firefight would take place, and you guys would get the call. So you were on call at all times, apparently.
Well, yes, we were on. We had enough teams at my time period that we would have a week of first alert, week of second alert, a week of training.
From the time you got the call, how long would it take you to get out, Bob?
Well, we were on the chopper pad within a half hour.
Okay.
Chopper ride out from there.
Okay, we're talking to Bob Konarski from West Virginia on Veterans Radio, and we're talking about the war dogs. These were amazing animals, and I talked to a first lieutenant one time that told about a dog that saved his life. They were on a patrol, and a dog handler in front, I assume it was a tracker dog, when the dog turned sideways in the trail and blocked the handler, and the LT said, get that dog moving, and the handler said, LT, he's blocking me for a reason. There's something up front, and I'm suspicious of that grove of trees. They called in artillery on it, then sent the people around on either side. When they got there, there were abandoned weapons, blood trails. There were no bodies because they'd all been taken away, but they were walking into an ambush. Was this common for the tracker dogs?
Yes, that particular situation never happened to me, but yes, I've heard stories of where the dogs would do something like that, you know, block the trail or some sort of an alert.
But Opal would try to go harder at them.
Right, she would try to pull harder to get towards our quarry.
What would you do at that point? Your heart must have been racing.
Yes.
What were you armed with? What kind of a weapon did you carry?
I carried a Car 15.
Which is?
It was basically a sawed-off M16, had the collapsible stock short barrel.
What size magazine?
I had an initial 30-round magazine, and then I had two of them taped together. So you could, on your initial, you could just flip your magazine over.
And a week's worth of hand grenades?
No, I didn't carry any hand grenades. I had to carry all my supplies plus 3 days of rations for the dog and extra water for the dog. So I was pretty well loaded down just with supplies for the dog.
Okay. It's not like they could go out hunting for their own food, right?
No, no.
Okay, so what happened when you made contact? And you said you knew that the enemy was within 15 yards. That's astounding. What did you do at that point?
Okay, generally, the idea was that we would stop, we would tell our support unit, okay, they are right over there, you know, or there, you know, that's where the enemy is. You want them, go get them.
Okay.
Our job was complete at that point.
What about spider traps, tunnels, and such?
I never had any experience with them, but some of the teams did. We did not go in tunnels.
But the dogs could find them, could they?
Yes. There was dogs trained just for tunnels.
Hey, Bob, this is Vance. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing good, Vance.
Good, good, good. Hey, you guys trained as a team, did you not?
We were trained individually or as a dog and handler, and then we were married up with a team at a certain point in the training.
Okay, but you guys stayed together for the most part unless you had to be replaced for
right.
Other reasons.
Right, rotations through. We were
Bob,
one
when,
team.
When you turned it over to the to the people behind you, and they would go in there on the attack? Is that what would happen?
Right. And they would go on the offensive. And
what would you guys do?
Kind of, you know, sometimes we were involved in the firefight, but basically it was the support unit's job to go in and finish off the enemy.
What would Opal do at a time like that?
she stuck by my side.
With all the noise and firing?
She was used to the sounds of combat, I guess. She would stay by me.
What would she do? Lay down, stand up? I mean, strain up the leash, want to get in on it?
Yes.
All of the above, right?
All of the above. You know, sometimes, you know, they would, kind of hang on your side. Sometimes they'd want to get in on the action.
Did you ever turn the dog loose?
No.
Okay. Were there dogs that were turned loose?
There were some dogs that were trained to work off leash. Some scout dogs were trained to work off leash.
But a scout dog was basically too valuable to take the chance on losing it, right?
Right. They all were.
Right, there you go. Right. I mean, it's the reason why they wouldn't be let loose. What kind of reaction did the enemy have? Do you know? I mean, they must have known about the dogs.
There was bounty on dogs and handlers.
You guys knew that?
Yes. One team was out, and they found a poster with a picture of a dog on it, and they brought it back, and it had it interpreted, and they says, the dogs and handlers are, there's a reward of $300 reward if they could verify a dog and handler kill.
That was about a decade's pay for those people.
Right, and $10 if they shot an officer. So we were more dead to them than an officer.
That took a second to sink in with me. All right, give us a story about Opal. What are some of your memories about her?
She was a sweet, lovable dog. My favorite memories is just how what a great companion she was. If we had to spend the night in the field, I would take her leash and hook it to my wrist or my ankle, and she would curl up next to me and sleep with me under my baby blanket.
Then you get back at the base, they'd go to a kennel, is that correct?
Right. We had a kennel area at the company area. We had to rebuild them after the CBs tried building them.
I'm surprised that we didn't take special care for the dogs. I mean, you grunts can take care of yourself.
Yeah, but no, they had their own kennel area.
Uh-huh.
And, they were fed a can of horse meat every day and a dry dog food that was mixed. And then when we went to the field, we had Gainsburg. I don't know if you people remember the Gainsburgers.
I do.
Were the little foil pouches.
Right.
Or
okay.
We would carry those for them in the field. And then we would mix the food up and put them together like that for them.
What about health care for these dogs? Were there veterinarians there?
Yes, there was veterinarians in country. I think the dogs got better health care than we did.
Well, the enemy thought they were more valuable. Why wouldn't our people?
I think at the time, they figured a fully trained scout dog was worth about $30,000, the value that the military...
How many weeks of training would they go through?
About 6 months.
And you said that Opal had been there before you.
Right.
How long had she been in country, do you know?
I'm not real sure, but I think she was in country about 3 years when I got her.
And when you left, who did she go to? You had to leave her one day. What happened
there? That will always be one of the worst days of my life. The day I had to say goodbye to her.
What happened?
She was euthanized.
Oh, sorry. Tell us again about, tell us some more about what it was like out in the field with Opal.
I guess she gave a definite confidence to being in the field. The dog's abilities to... smell and hear so much better than us gave me confidence that I knew I would be a little bit safer than if I didn't have a dog with me.
Would they know, would they be able to detect tripwires or mines?
Yes, Opal could detect a tripwire. She would come to a tripwire and stop, sit down.
And sit down?
Yes.
And you knew something was bad there?
Yeah, it's like, okay, oh. Something isn't right. She didn't say, here's a tripwire dummy. She, yeah, it's kind of like, okay, here's something that isn't right, that shouldn't be there. And it was up to us to determine what.
Bob, how did she detect the presence of the tripwire?
A lot of theory on that one, and one of the theories is they would hear the vibration of the air movement over the wire.
And then they could also smell the presence of the person who put it there and any explosives
right.
attached.
Right.
When Opal detected a tripwire or some other sort of booby trap, was it easy for you to spot, or did you have to say, look around and say, what did she see?
You would stop and look around. The tripwires weren't always obvious.
Was that something that you would do, or would somebody else from the team come up and take a look?
Generally, the visual tracker would come up, or the team leader. They would come up and determine what it was, because my hands were full holding on to the dog, my weapon.
Right.
And, so they could move a little bit easier than myself.
So there was probably a lot of congratulations and thanks to Opal when that happened.
Right.
Hey, Bob, why don't you give the Combat Tracker team's website so people can go visit it?
It is www.combattrackerteam.org.
www.combattrackerteam.org.
Correct.
Okay. Is there any last thing that you would like to say on your own?
I just hope everybody, appreciates, what the dogs are still doing for all our military people.
They're being used in Iraq and Afghanistan. I know that.
That's right.
In
the last couple of weeks, there was a national article going around about how the dogs are treated. Wounded dogs are being cared for now. And again, it sounds like our wonderful government is taking better care of the dogs than our veterans.
Well, that tells us something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Bob Konarski from West Virginia, dog tracker. Thanks for being on Veterans Radio, dog handler.
You're very welcome.
And so joining us is Vance McCrum, representing Dutch. Vance, welcome to Veterans Radio. Who are you with, and who is Dutch with, and who was Dutch?
Dutch was probably the finest dog that ever set foot in Vietnam, but each one of us handlers will tell you that.
I heard Bob say that Opal was the finest
dog. That's right, and as far as Bob is concerned, Opal was the finest dog. That's the way we respected our dogs, because they're responsible for us being here today, and each one of us will tell you that our dog was the finest.
And each one of you believes it.
And that's right.
That's good for you. Tell us, you were Air Force, and Dutch was a sentry dog, correct? Yeah.
Yes, I was in the United States Air Force. Dutch was a German Shepherd, a black and tan German Shepherd. And he was 7 years old, like Bob's Opal, when I went into Vietnam in 1965. We went in country in Project Top Dog, and there were 40 of us that took the first dogs in country in 1965. The United States did not use dogs in Vietnam at that time. And we were charged with protecting the critical bases and installations on the perimeters, and we worked only at night.
This was basically on-the-job training. You guys were trying to figure out systems and how things would work with the dogs, is that correct?
No, because the dogs were being used stateside and throughout the world. They just hadn't been used in Vietnam at the time.
All right. Tell us a little more about your job then. You worked at night?
We worked at night.
So when the sun was setting, it was time for you to go out.
When the sun went down, we went out. And we worked. When I was in Vietnam in 1965, there wasn't enough of us. I was up at Da Nang. There were only 15 of us at Da Nang at the time, so we worked from dusk till dawn. So it was pretty hard on the dogs, but they adjusted to it. They adjusted to the climate, and when it was time to get back to the kennels, and when after they were fed and groomed and the kennels cleaned and such, they went right to sleep.
I'll bet. Even at during the summertime in Vietnam, even at night, it's hot.
It's very hot.
I found a letter of mine that to my folks apologizing for not writing, but it went down to 85 degrees one night, and I'd caught a cold and hadn't been able to shake it.
That's true. It did. That temperature at night did feel kind of cold.
Right. For all of you people that never had the pleasure, it got hot in Vietnam. And so there's the dogs with a fur coat on. Did that help keep them cool, or did that?
Well, when we groomed the dogs, we groomed them in a manner that would help reduce some of the undercoat that keeps them warm in the winter.
Right.
And that grooming process would remove some of that and would help to keep them cool. And then, of course, in the winter, we didn't groom them that way because they need to keep that coat in the stateside.
Wintertime over there is rain.
There in Vietnam.
It did get cold
rain.
Up in the mountains,
yes.
Though. Right. And even down on the coast twice during the monsoons, I saw my breath. So it actually did get cold over there. So you'd go out, Dutch would be on a leash. Did you have a couple of types of leashes, or was there different gear that told Dutch when it was time to go to work?
Yes. The training gear that we used obviously was the 6-foot leather leash, and then we had a choke chain that was used for basic training, basic obedience, and so forth. The sentry dog's working gear was a collar, a leather collar. Once the dog saw the leather collar coming off your equipment loop, he knew it was time to get serious, whereas the combat tracker teams and the scout dogs used a harness, and that was their visual clue that it was time to get serious.
Dog would get excited, Woody? Or
their attitude would change.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. You could play with your dog just like you could your pet at home and wrestle around and play with them. And when you put the gear or brought the gear out that they were trained to use, their attitude changed and they knew it was time to go to business.
Okay, so you'd go out, you'd walk out a gate. Is that what it would be?
Typically, they would load us into a back of a deuce and a half truck, the dog and his handler, and there would be, depending on the area you were going to, there could be 6 or 8 guys, and we would be posted around the perimeter of the alert aircraft in Da Nang Air Base. And on the other side of the fence out there towards the Badlands were either the Marines or the Army people in foxholes protecting the perimeter. We would work on the base side of the fence working the perimeter. And we would be stationed out at post. We would straddle our dog, take the choke chain off, put the collar on, and the dog immediately determined he knew it was time to get busy, and he would start doing his job.
So the sentry dog would do his job by scenting or sensing?
Like Bob had mentioned earlier in the interview with the combat trackers, there are 3 senses, a sense of smell, a sense of sight at night. They can see much better than we can in the evening in the darkness hours. They see the movement. And of course, their sense of hearing is very acute. Those 3 senses are what we as handlers, regardless of the discipline, would watch and our dogs, because we were constantly watching our dogs. In the sentry dog case, they were only trained to detect the presence of somebody trying to penetrate the area we were charged with securing.
Okay, so you were between the base and our perimeter troops. And if the dog sensed something, how would you know it wasn't perimeter troops?
That's a great question, and it's the first time I've been asked that in a long time. It was quite an adjustment when we got in country, because stateside there wasn't anybody on the other side of the fence. It was just us and the dogs. And so if your dog alerted, there was somebody coming. They did adjust to the fact that there were people stationed there just by the fact of the routine of every night being out there. They knew it. It's when they got on the other side of the fence that the dogs would still alert. But we would get to the fence, and then the dogs would learn that it was friendly.
Okay.
You know, it was the Army or the Marine folks.
Well, I assume that every now and then you would have contact?
Every now and then we would have contact. In the areas that we patrolled that were not covered by the Marines and the Army folks on the perimeters, there was the opportunity, of course, for the enemy to try and penetrate those areas. And that's what we were charged to do, was to stop that penetration. When I was in country in 1965, early on, we didn't have two-way radios. They were there, but we didn't have them. They gave us a flare. And obviously, that's kind of a bullseye, so none of us carried them.
Well, then.
You know, they wanted us to pop a flare if there was contact made, so I'm sorry, but we're not going to do that.
You just made me think back to the flares. What was that movie Platoon. And one of the scenes that just brought everything back to me was that last battle scene with the flares coming down on the end of the parachutes and the shadows dancing all over the place. Just got that visual.
Yep.
So, okay, you wouldn't pop a flare. What would you do?
If there was gunfire or a firefight in that vicinity, the air police, at the time they were called air police, would hear it, of course, because of the proximity of it, and they would send a reactionary team out. Shortly afterwards, they did issue two-way radios where we could call for support. But like Bob had mentioned, our job was to detect. and then call for support and let the people come in who are trained for that function to go in there and sweep the area.
I'm still confused. You made contact. You didn't have the radio. You wouldn't use a flare. What would you do?
Well, you would use gunfire.
Oh,
you
okay.
You would respond to it. You know, you would use gunfire, and then they would hear it, and of course they would come. But it wasn't long after that that they started issuing us radios.
Okay. And you had contact? You had times when you had contact?
Most of the times the contact was then an alert from my dog, and Dutch would alert very aggressively, and we would come in close to the contact. And like Bob had mentioned, he could tell by how your dog reacts and how close you are to the enemy. Many, many times it was nothing more than a penetration attempt, and then they would disappear just to see if we were there.
But you,
or harassment type of thing.
But you wouldn't know that, so I assume,
not
again,
until you got up there.
Your heart was racing.
Oh, yeah, your heart's racing, and, you know, your heart's racing, the hair in the back of your neck's raised, and, you know, that all of that kind of stuff.
And when it turned out there wasn't anybody, it would take a while to determine that, I guess. But
yeah, it doesn't take long because the dog would take you to the point to where they were.
Okay.
And then you'd sweep the area to make sure it was good and clean.
Right.
And at that some point in time, if you weren't confident, then you would call for a reactionary team.
And so the enemy knew that you guys were out there with dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And any idea about what was going on with them if they knew that there was a dog and a handler coming?
Have no idea what their thought process were.
Sure.
Yeah.
They would just sneak away and hopefully.
Yeah.
Just, in fact, I assume you'd be hoping they'd sneak away.
Yes.
Stay tuned for the continuation of Gary Lilly's interview with dog handler Vance McCrum, and then the music of Michael J. Martin. We're back on Veterans Radio with Gary Lilly, finishing up his interview with dog handler Vance McCrum, and then don't miss our interview with Michael J. Martin.
Give us some talk about Dutch's personality a bit.
Dutch was a very, very headstrong, stubborn dog. I was
hence
his
Dutch.
Yeah, hence the name Dutch. Yeah, affectionately I referred to him as the Dutchman.
Okay.
If we were going through basic obedience training, sit down, come heel, stay. And if he didn't feel like doing it, there's a series of things a handler would do, verbally correct them, say no, sit, and then a little snap of the leash to sit and so forth. And Dutch would at some point say, look, if I wanted to sit, I would have sat, and, you know, and just kind of growl at me. Well, at that point, I say, you're the boss. Like Bob said, they trained us.
Okay.
You know? Dutch was my second dog, and I had to leave him in country. And train him to a new handler when I left. And as Bob said, that was, you know, a horrible day for me, you know, that period when I finally left country. He liked human contact. When he'd be in a heel position, he would lean his right shoulder into my left leg. And it's sort of not a good attention position when you're in a heel position, and I'd wiggle my left knee a little bit to have him sit straight in the heel position. And he loved lots of praise, verbal praise.
Okay, and we're with Dutch, who's being represented by Vance McCrum. Dutch was a sentry dog in Vietnam. Vance, we were talking off air a little bit about some of the training that these dogs would go through. Tell me about what you did, what the dogs did.
Well, we were the initial training on a sentry dog. The first thing the dogs were trained to do was the five basic commands: sit down, come, heel, and stay. And during that process, the handler also gets to learn how to train the dog to do that. And that's where you establish the amount of control and the verbal control you have over your dog, and you become the alpha male instead of the other way around in the training process. And then from there, we proceeded to the agitation side of it, where they would jump up and down. The instructors down at Lackland Air Force Base would jump up and down, holler and scream, and wave a burlap bag at the dog, trying to get the dog to be aggressive and growl and bark and run at the end of the leash and try and get after the guy. The dogs were not physically hit during this process, but they just made an attempt to make it look like they were going to strike it at the dogs.
Okay. So they went through all this training, and then they got turned over to somebody else. You mentioned that Dutch had been handled by somebody prior to you.
Yeah, I was Dutch's third handler, and as I mentioned earlier, he was 7 years old when I took him over. One thing I failed to mention was that during this training process is also when you train and you learn the dog, how the dog alerts to the scent, the sight, and the sound, and they're trained to do that. And this was a continuously training program that went on. I handled dogs for almost total of 4 years while I was in the Air Force for 4 years. And this was all part of the process.
Was this a job of choice, or were you assigned to the dogs?
It was a job of choice. You volunteered to be a dog handler. When I was in the service in the very early 60s, I volunteered to go to Vietnam, and I volunteered to be a dog handler. When I went through Air Police Training School, they took us down to the canine section, and they put on a demonstration for us. The class putting on the demonstration was just completing their 2 months or their 1 month training, 2 months training rather. And I raised my hand when they asked for volunteers, and we were interviewed, and they looked for personality traits, and they had questions, trick questions they would ask us. Then we were selected, and I went through the training.
Where would the dogs come from?
The dogs are purchased by the government. At the time, most of them come from stateside, and they were either donated or the United States government purchased them. We didn't get any at the time from overseas until much later in the Vietnam conflict, the Vietnam War, when the demand for dogs went up.
The dog would switch handlers. What was the adjustment period for the dog? Was that difficult for them
difficult,
to understand?
Very difficult for the dog. I was fortunate when I went through the training, I got a green dog. In other words, he had not been previously trained, so him and I learned together. When I took over Dutch at Altus Air Force Base in Altus, Oklahoma, I sat outside of his kennels. His handler had been discharged, and I read to him. And I talked to him, and I would talk to him just like you would a child, you know, in a child's voice. And you'd stick your hands inside, and he'd let you scratch the ear. And it was, you know, that was the procedure.
We've got a call coming in, I believe you said, from Australia, Ken. Good morning or good evening to Australia.
It's actually down under here. Alan Wood speaking.
How you doing, Alan?
Ex-tracker.
Alan, it's wonderful to hear from you.
It's nearly midnight here, so I thought I'd give you a call just before turning in, just to let you know it's coming through okay.
Wonderful.
I heard you say at the beginning of the show there that it was being sent down under as well, so I thought, well, I better let you know it is coming through okay.
Alan, you're a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah, 68-9.
68-9. Who were you with?
I was with 4th Infantry Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment in a tracker recon team. Usually we had about five or six guys go out. We had a dog handler, similar to what Bob was talking there, a dog handler, a visual tracker, cover man, a signaler, I think possibly a little different to your teams. We usually had a gunner with an M60 in his number two.
Okay. So
we usually went in a little more heavily armed.
What was your job? Were you a handler, or were you...
I was normally a cover man or one of these poor guys who had to carry the SIG set on the back of the old MPR-6, 25, rather.
Right. So what area did you operate? Australia.
We were down. I think it was Three Corps. I think you would call it down in just north of Vung Tau.
And that would be where the rubber plantations were.
Yeah. In that region.
There was a lot of activity there. You guys got.
It got a little hairy at times. We moved north a couple of times there, just to outside Long Bien. Did a bit of work there with 199th Light Infantry. The 11th Armored Cav.
Oh, we've got friends that were in that.
Sorry?
I said I've got friends that were in the 11th.
Were you? Did you?
Yes. So I see Dale over in the next booth. Dale was a slick pilot. I see him nodding his head at every place that you mentioned.
And we were outside. I think Black Horse was their base, wasn't it?
Black Horse was there, indeed. Dale's nodding his head, yes. And I know that that was one of the toughest... MASH-type hospitals. They got
Oh, was it?
They got more They got more activity than most places.
Yeah, you were. You mentioned you were with the 199th.
We did a little work with. We did a bit of work with 199th. Yeah.
Okay, that was a red catcher in Long Bend. That's where we were stationed, and also we worked with some of the Aussies down in Long Thon.
So, yeah.
So that's Dale speaking, the helicopter pilot. So Dale, you actually worked with the Aussies?
You probably gave me a ride sometime.
More than likely. It was a great opportunity working with the Australians. They're so professional and just really well disciplined people to work with.
Yeah.
I've heard that from a lot of in Chu Lai there was some there were some Australians up there, and everybody talked about the Australians. You see the Australians, man, they're really good.
Yeah, well, we had, during our time, we got there about mid-'68, and we had some of the guys who went on a break. They went up to Khe Sanh for a bit of a break, would you believe?
That's like the guys in World War II that got to go to the rest area that became known as the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah, Gary, you might mention that Alan and his wife Barbara were up here in Michigan.
That's right. Alan, you were up here doing some research at the University of Michigan Library this past summer, and that's how we got to know you and your wonderful wife, Barbara. She's a saint, isn't she?
Yeah, she's sitting behind me here with a dog on her lap.
Okay, tell her
we turn in.
Tell her Ann Arbor says hello to her. What would you like to tell us about your dog team?
Well, we had black labs. We probably had about, I think, all told, I would think about 12 or 15 there over the years. We had three in our platoon. As I say, we had about five or six. Well, that was five or six full strength, but quite often we didn't go out with a full team, as Bob would probably attest to. You quite often had guys down with malaria or on leave or whatever else, but you still went out. We did, from what listening to Bob there, it was very, very, very similar with what we did. We usually had company or platoon size Australian or New Zealanders backing us up coming through until when we had a contact, we hit the deck, and these guys would go through over the top of us.
So you're an Australian now living in New Zealand, is that correct?
No.
I'm sorry.
No.
Okay. Tasmania.
That'd be like saying you're a Yank living in Canada.
Okay. Yeah. Right. I'm sorry.
I think they were pretty professional, and the guys we did a lot of work with were the Kiwis, the New Zealanders, who there's a lot of Maori blood among them, and as somebody said to me once, they weren't soldiers, they were warriors.
And I've heard that these guys just almost seemed like they thrived on it.
They are a wild bunch. a wild bunch in camp, too, and they gave you the greatest confidence when you got into a scrap.
You told us about one time when you were in a firefight, laying on the face down, and what did you see over your left and right shoulder?
Well, I looked around, just not lifting my head off the ground, and these guys are going through, as I say, pure or half-bred Maori, M60 at the hip, letting out war whoops with a big grin from ear to ear, and the shit's flying around the ears.
Okay.
Al, you've got to be mad.
Thank you so much for phoning in all the way from Tasmania?
Tasmania. Which is the most southern state, an island state of Australia.
Do you guys
and we're just coming out of winter down here.
Vince has a question or a comment.
No, just before we went off air, what I wanted to do was to make all of our listeners aware that if they went to the NationalWarDogMonument.org, there is a organization that is attempting to get a memorial placed in Washington, D.C., and if people would go to that website, they can see a picture of the memorial.
Okay, great. We're going to let you go right now.
Yeah, for sure.
You can hit the rack. It's time for you to go to bed.
I think so.
Thank you so much for calling in. Wonderful to hear from you
again. Thanks, Al. It's good to talk to you again.
Fine. Fine. No problem.
Welcome
home,
brother.
Okay,
bye-bye. Bye. Okay, and that'll be it. We're wrapping up, and we want to thank Vance McCrum,
thank you.
Bob Konarski, Al from Tasmania, for being on the show with us.
Michael J. Martin served 12 months in Vietnam in the bush, mostly as a point man. A nice job.
Yeah. Never had to ask anybody what was going on.
That's true. He just kept moving forward. As part of the 11th Infantry, part of the AmeriCal Division, class of 68-69, good class, same one I was in. Citations include the Silver and Bronze Stars and Purple Heart and the Combat Infantryman's badge. And beginning in the early 80s, Martin and your friend Tim Doc Holliday, who was also decorated three-tour Navy Corpsman in Vietnam, started playing your music all over the country. Isn't that true?
Yeah, we didn't really plan it that way. We wrote some songs that Nashville told us to stay away from, relating to the so-called experience. But we started performing around the wall just about the time that it was dedicated, and our music kind of caught on, and we found that there was a hole that we needed to fill. So we did. Tim passed in 2000 from cancer, you know, so I miss him. But we were a couple of brothers, and we went out there and we started up. We went all over the country like a couple of old troubadours and played our music, and I think it's made a difference.
Let's draw the line again. Come together in the circle and remind ourselves when we made promises we owe to ourselves to keep. Let's draw the line again and remember what we said about our lives back then. Pledged allegiance to a dream we believe. Let's draw the line.
We're back listening to Veterans Radio, and that was Michael J. Martin. Great song, Michael.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I was just listening to it. I hadn't listened to it in a while, and I was just thinking that certainly does address some of the subjects that we're talking about here today. You know, that and welcoming these guys home and making them feel like they're part of the fraternity is so important. You know, that these guys and these gals, you know, that they know that there's a base here of real support, some people that are going to understand, that they don't have to explain everything to, that, you know.
No, you don't have to explain everything to us when you come back. We're aware of what it is that you're going through. We're aware of the stress levels that you're under, and, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Well, we, like I said earlier, Tim Holliday and I just felt like that we were filling a hole. We were addressing the thoughts and feelings of a whole lot of people out there that needed someone to express them. You know, Billy Joel and Bruce Springsteen, Charlie Daniels, a lot of different people recorded songs relating to Vietnam, but they weren't there. And that's a whole different perspective when you're getting the point of view of somebody who has been there. And that's the title of the new CD. And, you know, it's a cliche, but you put it in a context, and it's not. When you talk about been there, mm-hmm. That's got a certain connotation for the people who have indeed been there.
Well, that's for sure. And I thoroughly enjoyed your music and the opportunity that we've had to be together when we were on a panel, actually, at the University of Michigan last fall, I guess it was.
That was a great panel.
You know, and that was even before we went on the air with Veterans Radio. That was just another one of those kicks that got us going. I said, boy, this is really important that we get on that. There's a song that one of our listeners likes and that you've played. And we did a program called Women in the Military. And that was, we had three nurses on, and we had World War II, Vietnam, and not three nurses there. The woman was from Uzbekistan. She's about 19 years old from a local town in Dexter. And we played your suitcase song.
Suitcase Full of Secrets.
Suitcase Full of Secrets. I was wondering if you could play a little bit of that for us.
Well, it's, yeah, I suppose so. It's
I'm imposing here because I know it's a longer song, and we're going to kind of try and cut it down a little bit. But this goes out to Mary and the rest of the women who have been willing to pay that price themselves.
She's got a suitcase full of secrets. She's looking to unload baggage that she carries with her everywhere she goes. And on her wrist there is a bracelet with a name she might have known, a friend or a lover lost who never came back home. And her eyes have looked into the eyes of martyrs. Her hands have held their beating hearts. And no, it only makes it harder. And believing, Lord, it hurts too much to start. So turn away from the room for the dying. Keep your mind on keeping one alive. Turn away from the screaming and the crying. It's the only way one will survive. With her suitcase full of secrets, she walks down to the wall, finally sets it down, and shakes her head and starts to cry. And then a soldier stands beside her and puts a hand upon her shoulder, gently lifts her face and looks for something in her eyes. Said, I remember your sad eyes smiling, though I don't even know your name and you don't know mine. But I never even had the chance to tell you. Thank you for keeping me alive. Thank you for keeping me alive.
That's a great song. I love those types of things. Tell me a little bit more about your background. We were just talking while we were listening to Medal of Honor sequence about, you know, you went to school on a GI Bill like most of us did.
Yeah, yeah. I went straight out of high school, and within just a few months I was doing summer stock, and I was actually just on the fast track. I was already making a living as an actor, which is almost impossible.
Yeah,
you know. And I did summer stock, dinner theater, and then. And then I started to have difficulty getting cast because I was 1A, you know. So I said, well, let's get it over with. I thought that, you know, with all this talent, they'd probably put me in special services.
Then, yeah, they did.
And then they found out I could shoot. So the rest is infantry, you know. But I did music. I sang the whole time. Throughout the whole time I was in the Army, I kept trying to convince those people that I needed to be in showbiz, you know.
Well, been better than some of those Filipino bands that we got to see.
Oh,
although
yeah,
they didn't do too badly.
Did you ever see the Soul Sisters? S-E-O-U, from Korea. They couldn't speak English, but they could sing Respect just like Aretha. You know?
I think some of those USO shows that we saw were just amazing. I mean, you really couldn't tell if you closed your eyes, you couldn't tell the difference.
Right.
But I don't know if there's enough time for you to tell the story about how you tried to impress your DI with the sense of humor. Anybody, any military guy out there will love the story. Is there time?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Well, in basic training, you're supposed to stand facing, you know, at attention, your eyes are front. And, of course, one of the basic tactics of a drill sergeant is to get you to look the wrong way. And he was coming up, and he was bumping me on the side of the head with his little drill sergeant hat. And, of course, I looked at him, and he went, "Why are you looking at me, Baggett? Do you think I'm pretty?" And I thought, well, here's my opportunity to throw in a little John Wayne. I said, "Well, you sure look pretty when you get mad, drill sergeant." And after that, I was known as the maggot who thinks he's John Wayne, and they tormented me something terrible.
I was going to say, and you did how many push-ups and ran
how
far?
Oh, I've still got muscles.
Why did they feel like they had to get so into your face like that and just yell at you?
Because it was their job. Yeah. I've seen that on both ways, too. It was their job to make you want to kill. It's one thing to teach you how to kill, but to make you want to kill. And that's what they instilled in me. To this day, if I saw one of those people, I'd kill him.
Not good old Sergeant Steel. How do they get names like that? You know, I thought that the guy in the comic book, Sergeant Rock, was, you know, a pigment of some of them. But mine was Sergeant Steel.
We had a couple in our outfit. We called them Drill Sergeant God and Drill Sergeant Devil. And Drill Sergeant Devil, the only thing made him laugh was the sight of blood. That really got him going, you know. Who's that actor?
Jack Lance.
That's him?
I'm sorry.
I saw your picture on the front page of the paper. Something familiar right away I recognized. There was a screaming eagle on your shoulder and a thousand-yard stare in your eyes. Man, I remember just how weary war can make you, how your poor old eyes just get too tired to close. Oh, I could tell you're not the kind to ever let it break you. All I can see is you're not alone. Now you've been there. Now you've done that. I saw that thousand-yard stare and I knew. I wish that I could just put my arm around your shoulder. It's okay, soldier. I've been there too. I noticed how you held your hands together like you were praying, though you couldn't close your eyes. Just remember that this war won't last forever. Hang in there, soldier. Come home alive. Now you've been there. Now you've done that. I saw that thousand-yard stare and I knew. I wish that I could just put my arm around your shoulder. It's okay, soldier. I've been there too. Oh, I wish that I could just put my arm around your shoulder. It's okay, soldier. I've been there, too.
You've been listening to Michael J. Martin on Veterans Radio.
Take a moment to say goodbye to all my friends from the MCB3. It was great seeing you this weekend up in Petoskey, Michigan. and seeing guys that you served with 35, pushing 40 years ago now, it's really wonderful.
Who's gonna fight the fight when the last warrior is gone? And who's gonna keep the prize? Who's gonna sing the war song? Who's gonna stand in the face of a slight? Who's gonna right all the wrongs? Who's gonna fight the fight when the last warrior is gone?